feelings on the matter as self-evident, this court has repeatedly confirmed that the destiny of the woman must be shaped on her own conception of her spiritual imperatives and her place in society. In sum, the notion that the Partial Birth Abortion Ban Act furthers any legitimate governmental interest is, quite simply, irrational. The court's defense of the statute provides no saving explanation. In candor, the act and the court's defense of it cannot be understood as anything other than an effort to chip away at a right declared again and again by this court, and with increasing comprehension of its centrality to women's lives. Count it out again. Nothing prepared Lily Ledbetter for the anonymous note left in her mailbox one evening, decades into her time at the Goodyear tire plant. Not the union man who had told her he took orders from a bitch at home and wasn't about to take them from a bitch at work. Or the boss who told her she could improve her evaluation by meeting him at the Ramada Inn. Ledbetter never found out who left the torn piece of paper. It had her salary, and the salaries of three other tire room managers who had also started in 1979. They each made around $15,000 more than she did. That's when Ledbetter finally went to court. By the time she was staring down the Corinthian columns of the Supreme Court, a federal appeals court had told Ledbetter she had waited too long. She had had 180 days to sue, and the 11th Circuit Court of Appeals claimed the clock started when the company had first discriminated against her, before she even knew about it. Ledbetter's lawyers protested that each paycheck was itself an act of discrimination that restarted the clock. At oral argument, Ledbetter had watched RBG, alone among the men of the bench. We were around the same age, and she too had been one of the first women to break into her profession, Ledbetter wrote in her memoir. I might have been on the factory floor as she walked the hallowed halls of the American justice system, but I imagined that men in ties and men in jeans can act just the same. Ledbetter's timing was unlucky again. Missing O'Connor on the court by a few months, she got a majority opinion from business-friendly Justice Samuel Alito. He wrote, in clinical and brusque fashion, that Ledbetter should have filed a charge of discrimination within 180 days after each allegedly discriminatory employment decision was made and communicated to her. As RBG read another dissent from the bench, it was clear that she felt the same kinship Ledbetter had. It's the story of almost every working woman of her generation, which is close to mine, RBG later said. She is in a job that has been done by men until she comes along. She gets the job, and she's encountering all kinds of flack, but she doesn't want to rock the boat. RBG was now in steady enough position to rock that boat. From RBG's oral dissent in Ledbetter v. Goodyear Tire and Rubber Company. For additional commentary, please see the enhanced portion of this audiobook. In our view, the court does not comprehend or is indifferent to the insidious way in which women can be victims of pay discrimination. Today's decision counsels sue early on when it is uncertain whether discrimination accounts for the pay disparity you are beginning to experience. Indeed, initially you may not know that men are receiving more for substantially similar work. Of course, you are likely to lose such a less-than-fully-baked case. If you sue only when the pay disparity becomes steady and large enough to enable you to mount a winnable case, you will be cut off at the court's threshold for suing too late. That situation cannot be what Congress intended when in Title VII it outlawed discrimination on the basis of race, color, religion, sex, or national origin in our nation's workplaces. Title VII was meant to govern real-world employment practices, and that world is what the court ignores today. Comparative pay information is not routinely communicated to employees. Instead, it is often hidden from the employee's view. Small initial discrepancies, even if the employee knows they exist, may not be seen as grounds for a federal case. An employee like Ledbetter, trying to succeed in a male-dominated workplace, in a job filled only by men before she was hired, understandably may be anxious to avoid making waves. Ledbetter's initial readiness to give her employer the benefit of the doubt should not preclude her from later seeking redress for the continuing payment to her of a salary depressed because of her sex. Yet, as the court reads Title VII, each and every pay decision Ledbetter did not properly challenge wiped the slate clean. Never mind the cumulative effect of a series of decisions that together set her pay well below that of every male area manager. Knowingly carrying past pay discrimination forward must be treated as lawful. Ledbetter may not be compensated under Title VII for the lower pay she was in fact receiving when she complained to the EEOC. Notably, the same denial of relief would occur if Ledbetter encountered pay discrimination based on race, religion, age, national origin, or disability. This is not the first time this court has ordered a cramped interpretation of Title VII, incompatible with the statute's broad remedial purpose. In 1991, Congress passed a Civil Rights Act that effectively overruled several of this court's similarly restrictive decisions, including the one on which the court relies today. Today, the ball again lies in Congress's court. The legislature has cause to note and to correct this court's parsimonious reading of Title VII. Less than 2 years into its tenure, the supposedly consensus-seeking Roberts Court was bitterly divided. Roberts himself was making his mark that 2006-2007 term by taking whacks at campaign finance limits and by criticizing laws that tried to remedy racial discrimination for supposedly being racist in and of themselves. The way to stop discrimination on the basis of race is to stop discriminating on the basis of race, Roberts declared in his majority opinion striking down a school desegregation plan. RBG joined the dissents in both cases. RBG had never before read two dissents from the bench in one term, as she did with Carhart and Ledbetter, and people noticed. Cynthia Fuchs Epstein told the New York Times, "She has always been regarded as sort of a white-glove person, and she's achieved a lot that way. Now she is seeing that basic issues she's fought so hard for are in jeopardy, and she is less bound by what have been the conventions of the court." The piece was headlined, "In Dissent, Ginsburg Finds Her Voice at Supreme Court." RBG joked that the news came as a surprise to Marty. RBG made no apologies for the discord. At the end of that term, she warned in a speech, "I will continue to give voice to my dissent if, in my judgment, the court veers in the wrong direction when important matters are at stake." Metaphorically, at least, the gloves were off. They have never been a 13-year-old girl. The story of Lily Ledbetter wasn't over. RBG had urged Congress to take up the cause, but she had to be patient. A bill to undo the majority's damage to anti-discrimination law died in a Republican Senate in 2008, and Bush had already said he would veto it. The election of Barack Obama changed that. 10 days into his presidency, Obama signed the Lilly Ledbetter Fair Pay Act into law, with Ledbetter beaming in red behind him. RBG put a framed copy of the law on her wall. Her ideal of a dialogue between the branches of government had been made reality. Even so, RBG was still the only woman on the court, a struggle she found crossed ideological lines. That spring, the court heard oral argument in the case of 13-year-old Arizona student Savannah Redding, who had been strip-searched at school because another student had claimed Redding had given her prescription-strength ibuprofen. The court had to decide whether strip-searching kids was constitutional. But that morning, a few of the male justices, including at least one liberal, had trouble understanding what was so bad about what happened to Redding. "I'm trying to work out why this is a major thing to say strip down to your underclothes, which children do when they change for gym," Breyer mused. "In my experience, when I was 8 or 10 or 12 years old, you know, we did take our clothes off once a day. We changed for gym, okay? And in my experience, too, people did sometimes stick things in my underwear." The court erupted in uncomfortable laughter. Thomas guffawed the loudest. Breyer tried to recover. "Not my underwear. Whatever. By this point, he'd lost control of the room entirely. "I was the one who did it? I don't know. I mean, I don't think it's beyond human experience." Redding was about the same age as RBG's granddaughter, Clara. RBG had had enough. "It wasn't just that they were stripped to their underwear," she eventually snapped. "They were asked to shake their bra out, to shake, stretch the top of their pants, and shake that out." Weeks later, David Souter announced his retirement, and RBG broke protocol. She wanted to talk about Savannah Redding, even though the case hadn't yet been publicly decided. The debacle at oral argument, she told USA Today, was just, for me, Ledbetter repeated. She meant the men on the court were completely divorced from women's daily realities. "They have never been a 13-year-old girl," RBG said of the other justices. "It's a very sensitive age for a girl. I didn't think that my colleagues, some of them, quite understood." They didn't understand Savannah Redding, and they didn't listen to Ruth Bader Ginsburg. "I don't know how many meetings I attended in the 60s and the 70s where I would say something, and I thought it was a pretty good idea," RBG said. "Then somebody else would say exactly what I said. Then people would become alert to it, respond to it." Startlingly, the queen of collegiality now publicly accused her colleagues of repeating the bad old days. "It can happen even in the conferences in the court," RBG continued. "When I will say something, and I don't think I'm a confused speaker, and it isn't until somebody else says it that everyone will focus on the point." That time, when RBG spoke, the men listened. On May 26, 2009, Obama nominated Sotomayor. And on June 25th, the court ruled unanimously that the school's strip-searching Redding had been unconstitutional. RBG later told me she had changed her colleagues' minds. "As we live, we can learn," she said. "It's important to listen, so I'm very glad that case came out as it did." A raging storm. In 2006, Republicans and Democrats had come together to declare that even more than 40 years after its passage, the Voting Rights Act was still necessary to protect minorities from disenfranchisement. A reauthorization of the 1965 legislation was unanimously approved in the Senate, passed 390-33 in the House, and signed into law by George W. Bush. However, this consensus hid a bubbling conservative rebellion. Decades earlier, a young Reagan administration lawyer named John Roberts had co-authored a memo arguing that the law should be written such that incidents of voter suppression would not be too easy to prove, since they provide a basis for the most intrusive interference imaginable. Apparently, it was harder for Roberts to imagine the intrusiveness of being blocked from voting. At oral argument for Shelby County v. Holder, on February 27, 2013, Scalia had a theory for why the law had been so popular in Congress. "I think it is attributable, very likely attributable, to a phenomenon that is called perpetuation of racial entitlement," Scalia said. "It's been written about. Whenever a society adopts racial entitlements, it is very difficult to get out of them through the normal political processes. Black people," he implied, "had wrested control of the government, and the poor politicians were too scared of looking racist to do anything about it. The court had to rescue them." In the lawyer's lounge of the court, people listening gasped aloud. Conservatives talked a big game about the tyranny of unelected justices, but in Shelby, the justices overrode elected officials to strike down a major portion of a law that helped people get access to the ballot. "The court has the reputation of being conservative, but if you take activism to mean readiness to strike down laws passed by Congress, I think the current court will go down in history as one of the most active courts in that regard," RBG told the New York Times. Her grim predictions have come true. In the years since Shelby, states have jumped to make it harder to vote, in a passel of laws whose impact falls disproportionately on people of color and the poor. "We put down the umbrella because we weren't getting wet," RBG said. But the storm is raging. From RBG's dissent in Shelby County v. Holder. For additional commentary, please see the enhanced portion of this audiobook. Voting discrimination still exists. No one doubts that. but the court today terminates the remedy that proved to be best suited to block that discrimination. The Voting Rights Act of 1965, VRA, has worked to combat voting discrimination where other remedies had been tried and failed. Particularly effective is the VRA's requirement of federal preclearance for all changes to voting laws in the regions of the country with the most aggravated records of rank discrimination against minority voting rights. A century after the 14th and 15th Amendments guaranteed citizens the right to vote free of discrimination on the basis of race, the blight of racial discrimination in voting continued to infect the electoral process in parts of our country. Early attempts to cope with this vile infection resembled battling the Hydra. Whenever one form of voting discrimination was identified and prohibited, others sprang up in its place. This court repeatedly encountered the remarkable variety and persistence of laws disenfranchising minority citizens. Answering that need, the Voting Rights Act became one of the most consequential, efficacious, and amply justified exercises of federal legislative power in our nation's history. Requiring federal preclearance of changes in voting laws in the covered jurisdictions, those states and localities where opposition to the Constitution's commands were most virulent, the VRA provided a fit solution for minority voters as well as for states. Under the preclearance regime established by Section 5 of the VRA, covered jurisdictions must submit proposed changes in voting laws or procedures to the Department of Justice, DOJ, which has 60 days to respond to the changes. A change will be approved unless DOJ finds it has the purpose or the effect of denying or abridging the right to vote on account of race or color, IBID. In the alternative, the covered jurisdiction may seek approval by a 3-judge district court in the District of Columbia. Congress approached the 2006 reauthorization of the VRA with great care and seriousness. The same cannot be said of the court's opinion today. The court makes no genuine attempt to engage with the massive legislative record that Congress assembled. Instead, it relies on increases in voter registration and turnout, as if that were the whole story. Without even identifying a standard of review, the court dismissively brushes off arguments based on data from the record and declines to enter the debate about what the record shows. One would expect more from an opinion striking at the heart of the nation's signal piece of civil rights legislation. Leaping to resolve Shelby County's facial challenge without considering whether application of the VRA to Shelby County is constitutional, or even addressing the VRA's severability provision, the court's opinion can hardly be described as an exemplar of restrained and moderate decision-making. Quite the opposite. Hubris is a fit word for today's demolition of the VRA. Volumes of evidence supported Congress's determination that the prospect of retrogression was real. Throwing out preclearance when it has worked and is continuing to work to stop discriminatory changes is like throwing away your umbrella in a rainstorm because you are not getting wet. The sad irony of today's decision lies in its utter failure to grasp why the VRA has proven effective. The court appears to believe that the VRA's success in eliminating the specific devices extant in 1965 means that preclearance is no longer needed. With that belief, and the argument derived from it, history repeats itself. By June 2014, people knew to scan for Ginsburg J. filed a dissenting opinion. 5 Republican-appointed male justices decided that not only did corporations have religious consciences, those consciences allowed them to opt out of covering birth control on their insurance plans. No big deal, said the majority in Burwell v. Hobby Lobby. Just ladies' stuff. Weeks later, when Katie Couric asked RBG, "Do you believe that the 5 male justices truly understood the ramifications of their decision?" RBG replied, "I would have to say no." "Did they, as men, show a blind spot?" Couric pressed. RBG said they did. Contraceptive protection is something every woman must have access to control her own destiny, RBG said. I certainly respect the belief of the Hobby Lobby owners. On the other hand, They have no constitutional right to foist that belief on the hundreds and hundreds of women who work for them who don't share that belief. RBG's most famous words in the Hobby Lobby dissent could have appeared in any of her searing dissents. The court, I fear, has ventured into a minefield. Chapter 9. I just love your flashy ways. Irene Carmone. I heard you can do 20 push-ups. RBG. Yes, but we do 10 at a time. Laughs. And then I breathe for a bit and do the second set. MSNBC interview, 2015. A lot of people throw around the word unstoppable when they talk about RBG, but they should know that it is literally true. Like the time the justice had a cracked rib, which wasn't about to stop her from keeping her twice-weekly personal training session. Bryant Johnson has been her trainer for almost 2 decades. He tried telling her in chambers that day in 2014 that he wasn't going to let RBG work out until her bone healed. Johnson is sitting in his Washington, D.C. office as he tells the story, still incredulous. He remembers what her secretary told him in response. She doesn't want to hear that. It's not like Johnson isn't used to toughness. An Army Reserve Sergeant First Class, he used to jump out of helicopters and airplanes. He was deployed in Kuwait. He's also gotten accustomed to the kind of grit that comes in a power blazer rather than fatigues. Impressive professional women are basically his client specialty. But RBG is the one he calls TAN, tough as nails. I mean, she's not the heaviest or stoutest lady, but she's tough, says Johnson. She works just as hard in the gym as she does on the bench. RBG had always been thin, but after colorectal cancer, Marty started saying she looked like an Auschwitz survivor. He was the one who told her in 1999 she had to see a trainer, along with Sandra Day O'Connor, who had advised RBG to stay active during cancer. Being a night person, RBG never made it to O'Connor's 8 a.m. aerobics class, which O'Connor had basically required female clerks to attend. At 29, RBG discovered the Canadian Air Force workout at a tax conference with Marty, and she has performed it almost daily since. Designed in the 1950s, its moves include quick spurts of toe-touching, knee-raising, arm-circling, and leg-lifting. For most of her life, people have thought of RBG as formal, cold even. But there was another, less guarded side. The one that came out when she threw herself into horseback riding or water skiing. One summer when they were both teaching in Aspen, Colorado, Bert Newborn, RBG, and a few other friends went whitewater rafting on the Colorado River. RBG was pushing 60, and she had never been a large woman. I told Ruth she should sit in the back of the boat, because she was so light that if they hit a rock she would go flying over, Newborn says. Her response? I don't sit in the back. A few years later, a friend recruited by Marty to lobby for RBG's nomination to the court, and Gerald Cohen, said, early on it came out that President Clinton was looking for a young jurist, and I pointed out that she's in great physical shape. In residence for a week at the University of Hawaii in 1998, already a justice, RBG gleefully went paddleboarding. When RBG and O'Connor gave the U.S. Olympic women's basketball team a tour of the court, including the highest court in the land, the basketball court upstairs, RBG gamely agreed to take a shot. A little practice, the players agreed, and she could be a point guard. At her 75th birthday celebration at the Second Circuit, the court of appeals she oversees, RBG was asked whom she wanted to record a birthday greeting for her to be played on a screen. She surprised everyone by picking legendary Yankees manager Joe Torre. After massive surgery, chemotherapy, and radiation, the whole works, RBG conceded, it was time to rebuild. Her friend Gladys Kessler, a federal judge in Washington, D.C., had a recommendation for her. Johnson, whose day job was in Kessler's office as a records manager. Johnson didn't quite know what she had been through, but he didn't really care. He would meet her where she was and go from there. And RBG took to strength training like she does everything else, with ferocious determination and without complaint. She uses her mind every day, says Johnson, and I make sure she uses her body. He started with having her do push-ups on the wall, feet on the ground. RBG said skeptically, "Push-ups?" And Johnson replied, "Yes, push-ups." In their first few months of training, Johnson was worried that he hadn't gotten any feedback from RBG. "If the justice didn't like you," one of her secretaries told him, "you wouldn't still be here." He didn't ask that question again. Johnson still has the broad shoulders and iron posture of a military man, but he likes to wear blue-tinted glasses and answer emails with, "Cool in the gang." Johnson comes across as a man who is used to making awkward, cerebral people feel comfortable, which is to say he is comfortable with himself. He cracks jokes and says RBG even laughs at them, despite her old rep, including with her kids, for not having a sense of humor. There's a competition happening in his office for floor space, between boxes of yellowed archival documents and duffel bags of exercise equipment. On the corner shelf sits a notorious RBG t-shirt, along with an I Love RBG hat, both gifts from his most famous client. A half-unzipped black bag under his desk reveals a pair of boxing gloves that are usually used by his second most famous client, Justice Elena Kagan, who came to him on RBG's recommendation. He gets these women, how they have had to barrel fearlessly, but not too hard, through the world. Being a woman in this city, you've got to be able to put up with a little bit and be able to take a lot of it, he says. You're looking at Justice Ginsburg, Judge Kessler. These are women that, when they came through, they were told, "You want to be a lawyer? You can be a paralegal. You can't be a lawyer." Still on reserve duty, he also works on sexual assault prevention and victim advocacy, helping service members who have filed sexual assault complaints know their options and seeing them through the process. Does he call himself a feminist? "I have been raised with a lot of strong women in my life that help influence how I look at women," he says, "which is as equal to a man." He hastens to add his grandmother taught him to always open doors for women. After the wall push-ups came push-ups on her knees. After that, push-ups with knees off the ground. That was when, Johnson gloats, I could see the light in her eyes. Sometimes she'll go over 20. Sometimes he has to protect her from herself on that, too. Johnson was never one of the people who saw RBG's bird-like build or her post-cancer pallor and thought that was it. A few years ago, the New Yorker's Jeffrey Toobin, who described RBG as frail in one of his books on the court, learned the error of his ways in a pretty direct fashion, as in Marty in his face, asking him, "How many push-ups can you do?" As Toobin struggled to come up with a number, Marty retorted, "My wife can do 25, and you wrote that she was frail." Bryant Johnson still gets asked if the justice actually does girl push-ups with her knees down. He rejects that term, and anyway, she doesn't. "A push-up is a push-up is a push-up," he says. "I don't look at the fact that they're a woman by limiting what they can do." That's not to say he doesn't see any difference between men and women at the gym. In fact, he sees some right inside the special justices-only gym where he trains RBG. "I've seen the chief there, and Justice Breyer," Johnson says. He rolls his eyes. "Men, we have that ego thing. Yeah, I know how to do it. I know how to lift weights. I know how to work on a car." Women understand. "Yeah, I don't know how to lift weights," he says. "Justice Ginsburg knows about the law, but when it comes to personal training, I explain it to you." The only thing she tries to explain to him is opera. "Sometimes I understand it," confesses Johnson. "Sometimes I'm like, yeah, that's her thing." Before there was a television in the justice's gym, RBG would work out to classical music. A jazzercise class she attended in the early 90s, she told the New Republic in horror, was accompanied by loud music, sounding quite awful to me. Now PBS's NewsHour is usually on while they train. "I even became a fan of NewsHour," Johnson says, not exactly with enthusiasm. He was pretty relieved the first time Kagan asked to flip to ESPN's SportsCenter for her own gym time. And he was thrilled to teach Kagan how to box. "How many women know how to punch? It's not a ladylike thing," says Johnson. "But there's nothing like the sound of leather hitting leather. When you hear that pop sound..." He mimes a punch and makes the sound, "buh, buh, buh." That's a feeling that sometimes women don't get. He's even created an extended boxing sequence he calls the Kagan Combination. One evening, and her training sessions are almost always in the evening, usually at 7 p.m., when RBG's session directly followed Kagan's, she asked about those gloves. Johnson suggested the senior justice give them a thump. She said, "No, we'll leave that for her." So had RBG finally found her limit? Johnson has a theory about that. She's already empowered. If he wanted to, Johnson could take some credit for the fact that RBG has kept up her daunting work output and her frenetic social schedule past the age of 80. Mostly, he's just happy that, he says, RBG hasn't lost any bone density since they began training, which beats the odds for her age. "She fell in her chambers once, on her hip," he said. "What happens to older women when they fall?" Johnson was referring to the fact that they often break bones. "She went to the doctor, came back, and said, 'Nothing's broken.' That was my report card." They had a scare during one training session, when RBG started feeling lightheaded. Her chest felt constricted, and she broke out in a sweat. She wondered whether it was because she had stayed up the night before writing an opinion and wanted to ignore it. "I was very stubborn," she says. Johnson called her secretary, who, as RBG puts it, in her gently persuasive way, insisted she go to the hospital. As Johnson saw RBG to the ambulance, he promised, "You ain't going out on my watch." He added something else that made RBG smile. "I said, 'Justice, you do realize this is not going to get you out of doing these push-ups.'" An EKG showed she had a blocked right coronary artery, and doctors put in a stent. "I was fine," RBG told me. "No more constriction in my chest. I wanted to go home." She laughed. The doctors insisted she stay in the hospital 2 nights. When her hospital stay became public, Johnson got a text message from a fellow trainer in Ohio whom he'd met at a fitness convention, where RBG was an instant hero. "Yo, B, what you doing to the justice, man?" his friend demanded. "I'm like, how do you know?" "We keep NPR on." The heart stent was inserted on a Wednesday. RBG still wanted to train on the following Monday. That time, Johnson relented, as long as they only did stretching exercises. By then, he knew she would pick working out over almost anything else, even her own bones, even dinner with the president. RBG plainly adores Barack Obama. She calls him sympathique, a French word that is one of her highest forms of praise. And yet one night, Johnson remembers, RBG slipped out early from a dinner at the White House. After all, she had a date at the gym.
"I said, 'You left the president for me?'" Johnson recalls. "Oh man, extra push-ups for you."
The notorious RBG workout. The justice starts with a 5-minute warm-up on the elliptical, followed by stretching and rotational exercises. Lately, Bryant Johnson has her do one-legged squats, holding onto his hands, and planks, where he does his best to knock the tiny justice down. But the signature move is one that Johnson describes as the exercise that will actually stop you from having to have a nurse 24/7, preventing the client from getting to the moment you can't sit down at the toilet and get up. 1. Sit down on the bench with a 12-pound ball. RBG started with a 2-pound ball and made her way up.
"The first time I gave her the 12-pound ball, it almost threw her," Johnson says.
2. Stand up, holding the ball with 2 hands. Press it to your chest. 3. Toss it to Johnson, who hands it back.
"I don't want to take the chance she misses it and it hits her. That wouldn't be a good look. Just think of the paperwork I would have to fill out."
4. Sit back down on the bench. 5. Repeat 10 times. RBG's swag. Among rows of black robes, in a city of sensible conformity, RBG has boldly staked out her own aesthetic. Like everything else about RBG, it is precise, elegant, and at times unexpectedly audacious. And every detail matters, not just because she's a perfectionist, although she is, but because it tells a story. The lacy collar, or jabot,
The visual she is most known for, a glimpse into her closet and chambers, shows she has at least a dozen, started out as a quietly political statement about women on the bench. You know, the standard robe is made for a man because it has a place for the shirt to show, and the tie, RBG said. So Sandra Day O'Connor and I thought it would be appropriate if we included as part of our robe something typical of a woman. So I have many, many collars. She and O'Connor took something that had never been made with a woman in mind, because no one ever imagined the world other than how it was, and they made it theirs. Male justices gussied up, too. Rehnquist added gold stripes to his robes in a nod to Gilbert and Sullivan's Iolanthe. RBG, a huge Gilbert and Sullivan fan herself, once jokingly presented him with a white English-style wig. And John Paul Stevens had his trademark bow ties. But RBG's jabots are a language of their own. The justice who despises frippery in her writing uses her neck accessories as a rhetorical flourish. The glass-beaded velvet bib necklace she wears to dissent is made by Banana Republic, obtained from the gift bag when she was one of Glamour's Women of the Year. It looks fitting for dissent, she said simply. RBG's majority opinion jabot, not seen too often these days, dangles with gold trim and charms. It was a gift from her law clerks. One of her favorites, a uniform crocheted white ring, was first spotted in a museum in Cape Town, South Africa. Another was purchased in the gift shop of the Metropolitan Opera, a two-pronged copy of the collar worn by one of her favorite tenors, Placido Domingo, in Verdi's Stifelio. That reminded her of what she called one of the best days of her life, when Domingo surprised her by serenading her as they both received honorary degrees from Harvard. Her favorite tenor! And it was belated justice a half-century after the dean of the law school had denied her a Harvard degree, all in a day. It was glorious, she said. So far, however, her efforts to pass on the collar habit to the younger generation have stalled. At the Supreme Court, justices are sworn in twice, the second time publicly in a formal proceeding known as an investiture. At Sotomayor's 2009 ceremony, the newest justice wore a jabot that encircled her neck with a row of lace, culminating in two lace blossoms and a flap of plain starched white down the center. It was a gift from Justice Ginsburg, reporters were told. But judging from court sketches and official portraits, it didn't last. Sotomayor is generally spotted in her trademark dangly earrings paired with an unadorned robe. Kagan was already a good friend of RBG's when she joined the court, but she drew a firm sartorial line from the start. I think you just have to do what makes you feel comfortable, Kagan said not long into her tenure. In my real life, I'm not a frilly, lacy person. Some of the things people wear just struck me as not something I felt comfortable with. RBG did not hold it against her. If the jabot is RBG's mark of individuality, every justice's robe is meant to signal a kind of uniformity. It's, I think, a symbol of we are all in the business of impartial judging, RBG said of the black cloaking. And in the United States, I think the pattern was set by the great Chief Justice John Marshall, who said that judges in the United States should not wear royal robes. They should not wear red robes or maroon robes. They should wear plain black. At the time, though, Marshall assumed an all-male bench. I didn't know anyone who made robes for women justices, said O'Connor, who bore the burden of being the first female justice. Most of what was available was something like a choir robe or an academic robe. RBG's usual robe is from England, a Lord Mayor's robe she likes. Off the bench, when she judges mock trials, she occasionally allows herself a little more pomp. As a guest in China in the 90s, she admired the judges' red and black robes, and was eventually given one as a gift. The judiciary is not a profession that ranks very high among the glamorously attired, RBG declared from the hallowed stage of Carnegie Hall at Glamour's Women of the Year event. But RBG herself is an exception. She's long been a dark horse darling of the glossies. Her outfits at her confirmation hearing earned praise in the New York Times Magazine from none other than legendary fashion editor Carrie Donovan, formerly of Vogue and Harper's Bazaar. when she turned up at the Senate last summer in a swingy pleated skirt and striped tunic-length top with a string of beads, she looked more pulled together than any woman in the Washington Eye since Jackie Kennedy Onassis, Donovan wrote. Writing about a visit to RBG's chambers in the same magazine in 1997, Jeffrey Rosen also compared her aplomb with Jackie O and her famous televised White House tour, and then offered this unusual rhapsody. It was hard not to be struck by her improbable glamour. Scarcely more than 5 feet tall, in a turquoise Chinese silk jacket with matching wide-legged pants, her black hair pulled tightly back in a ponytail, she looked like an exquisite figurine. A secretary at Marty's law firm in New York, who became a feminist after typing up RBG's briefs for her, remembered being flummoxed when the lady lawyer appeared in a green dashiki, looking nothing like the secretary had imagined. These days, RBG favors regal, loosely fitting robes of brocades or embroidered silks, usually accented with statement jewelry, ropes of pearls, a single string of red she has been wearing for decades, or a large pendant. She doesn't have her ears pierced, but often wears prominent colored stud or dangling earrings. RBG often picks things up when she's traveling. David Scheiser remembers her jokingly complaining that because Marty wasn't much of a shopper, Nino, that would be Justice Antonin Scalia, would go with her instead. Rarely does she go casual. According to Jeffrey Toobin's The Nine, during a massive snowstorm, RBG and the other justices were picked up in jeeps for oral argument. Ginsburg chose to wear a straight skirt and high heels, Toobin reported. Because of the snow on the ground and Ginsburg's outfit, the driver, who usually worked in the clerk's office, had to lift the tiny justice into the air and deposit her in the car. Later, Ginsburg wrote the fellow a letter of recommendation for law school. Dress is one issue on which RBG can be a conservative. Her oldest granddaughter, Clara, says RBG will not so subtly offer her a shawl if she thinks Clara's shirt is too low cut. In her freshman year of college, Clara got her nose pierced, along with a total of 13 piercings in her ears, much to RBG's horror. She kept calling it that thing on your face, Clara says, amused. To me, RBG expressed relief that at least a nose ring, unlike a tattoo, could be easily removed. At public functions, RBG wears gloves, often black or white lace. In the dead of winter in Michigan, she wore daring knee-high leather boots. She usually carries the Constitution in her handbag, and after she got an M.Z. Wallace tote in the glamour gift bag, she liked it so much she bought another. She bought one for Clara, too. She has a weakness for Ferragamo shoes. RBG's hair is invariably combed back severely, often affixed with a scrunchie. Every once in a while, she would come to chambers wearing a turban, and her secretaries would warn the clerks, according to one of them, that it was a turban day, so that we wouldn't giggle when we saw her. RBG's chambers are evidence of her finely attuned taste. There is a statue of Eleanor Roosevelt, conventional enough. But then RBG had the standard desk the Supreme Court justices have, topped with a black granite top. Although she has said her favorite artist is Matisse, given her pick of art from Washington Museum collections, as all justices are, her choices were more obscure. She favors the mid-20th century American artist Ben Cunningham, whose abstract work his biographer describes as combining logic with imagination to add new dimensions to our experience of social confrontation and protest. Another favorite in the same geometrical color-blocked vein is the German-born Joseph Albers. In 2011, she coyly said she wouldn't retire at least until she got her Albers back from a traveling exhibition. She estimated that would happen sometime in 2012. The day came and went. She has borrowed paintings by Mark Rothko and Max Weber, too. A sparrow, except in her dreams. RBG weeps at the opera. She could get quite sentimental in movies, says Jane, but opera is in an emotional class of its own. RBG is often wistful about what could have been had she only been born with the pipes. If I had any talent that God could give me, I would be a great diva, she said. But sadly, I have a monotone, and my grade school teachers were very cruel. They rated me a sparrow, not a robin. She sings anyway, but only in the shower and in my dreams. It all started when 11-year-old Kiki sat in a Brooklyn high school and watched, electrified, as a conductor named Dean Dixon conducted La Gioconda. She would also always remember that Dixon, an African-American whose career thrived in Europe, was held back for reasons that had nothing to do with his talent. In all the time he conducted in the U.S., she told the Santa Fe New Mexican during one of her many visits to that city's summer opera festival, Dixon was never called maestro, the customary respectful term for a conductor. She and Marty were in the audience in 1961 when the legendary soprano Leontine Price, an African-American who battled racism on the stage and beyond, made her Metropolitan Opera debut in Il Trovatore. RBG remembered how a spotlight shone on the proud faces of Price's parents, a Mississippi mill worker and midwife. Decades later, RBG greeted Price at the court by taking her hand and exclaiming, "My, this magnificent woman!" When Price spontaneously sang at lunch, a reporter in the room was pretty sure Justice Kennedy, another opera fan, shed a tear. Opera ran in Marty's family, too. Jane remembers that her paternal grandmother, RBG's beloved surrogate mother, Evelyn, listened every Saturday to the Metropolitan Opera broadcasts, and Evelyn's own father had been a mechanic in an opera house in Odessa. When RBG and Marty were stationed in Oklahoma, they drove 4 hours to Dallas to hear the Metropolitan Opera's traveling performance and borrowed opera records from the library on base. Later, in New York, they shared a box at the Met and went every Friday, a secular Sabbath. In Washington, they chose an apartment at the Watergate, right across the street from the John F. Kennedy Center, home to the Washington National Opera. Opera stars often speak of her visits backstage and her reverential but knowledgeable comments after the curtain falls. "We do consider her, informally, part of the family," the opera's president said. The justice also is a regular at the theater. "She has terrific taste and she's very knowledgeable," says Michael Kahn, artistic director of the Shakespeare Theater Company, at whose wedding RBG officiated. Being an opera fan on the highest court has its perks, including at least 3 onstage turns as an extra. One of these was with Scalia in Ariadne auf Naxos, where RBG batted a fan and wore a white wig. One singer hopped on Scalia's lap. In a 2003 production of Die Fledermaus, she, Kennedy, and Breyer surprised everyone on stage when they were introduced as 3 guests supreme from the court supreme. The best part? "Domingo was about 2 feet from me. It was like an electrical shock ran through me," RBG said. RBG now oversees twice annual opera and instrumental recitals at the court. As she put it in a speech, they provide a most pleasant pause from the court's heavy occupations. Chapter 10. But I Just Can't Quit. Erin Carmone. "And when the time comes, what would you like to be remembered for?" RBG. "Someone who used whatever talent she had to do her work to the very best of her ability, and to help repair tears in her society, to make things a little better through the use of whatever ability she has." MSNBC Interview, 2015. RBG does not like to be told to slow down. In early 2009, just as people began counting her out, RBG was suddenly everywhere. Yes, she had been diagnosed with pancreatic cancer, but the tumor was small and detected early. Yes, a Democratic president had been elected with a Democratic Senate, laying the groundwork for a successor she could approve of. But RBG had a job to do, and she wasn't done yet. There she was on February 23rd, smiling broadly from the bench less than 3 weeks after surgery, asking pointed questions at oral argument. There she was on February 24th, taking her seat with the other justices at the first black president's inaugural speech to a joint session of Congress. "Some of us were angry with her, but we were wrong," David Schizer said. "We kept telling her to slow down. We kept telling her to take it easy." He sent her novels to read. She wouldn't have any of it. RBG, as ever, had a purpose. First, I wanted people to see that the Supreme Court isn't all male, she said. Then, referring to Kentucky Senator Jim Bunning, who had predicted she was at death's door, she added coolly, I also wanted them to see I was alive and well, contrary to that senator who said I'd be dead within 9 months. That night, she paused to embrace the new president.
I've got a soft spot for Justice Ginsburg, Obama later said, and the feeling was mutual.
There was a rapport from the start between us, RBG said. A decade earlier, her bout with a more advanced stage of colorectal cancer had given her a new outlook. It is as though a special, zestful spice seasons my work and days, RBG said after her first recovery. Each thing I do comes with a heightened appreciation that I am able to do it. That was doubly true the second time around. That spring, in a tribute to mark her 15 terms on the bench, Chief Justice John Roberts offered his warm congratulations on the occasion of your reaching the midpoint of your tenure, adding that she had earned acclaim for your work ethic, intellectual rigor, precision with words, and total disregard for the normal day-night work schedule adhered to by everyone else since the beginning of recorded history. If it really was the midpoint of her tenure, she'd be retiring only a year older than John Paul Stevens did, at age 91. None of these public displays of vigor stilled the retirement drumbeat. As Obama ran for re-election, Harvard Law School professor Randall Kennedy wrote what insiders had been whispering. Thurgood Marshall, for whom Kennedy had clerked, had retired in ill health, allowing George H.W. Bush to replace him with the ultra-conservative Clarence Thomas. Now, if Justice Ginsburg departs the Supreme Court with a Republican in the White House, one that could be elected in 2012, it is probable that the female Thurgood Marshall will be replaced by a female Clarence Thomas, Kennedy wrote. Technically, Kennedy aimed his advice at the 5 years younger Breyer, too. Those, like me, who admire their service might find it hard to hope that they will soon leave the court. But service comes in many forms, including making way for others, he wrote. It was RBG, however, and not Breyer, who was essentially followed around with a microphone pointed at her, journalists asking her when she would just get out already. After Barack Obama was re-elected, the clamor didn't stop. After all, the Democrats faced an all but certain drubbing in the Senate in 2014, so there was a tiny window for Obama to appoint another liberal justice. Democrats were indeed drubbed. Women who had seen older women pushed out before, or been pushed out themselves, were furious at the pressure on RBG. Longtime Supreme Court chronicler Linda Greenhouse flat out called it sexist. I am just pissed as hell at my friends, liberal law professors who urge her to retire, says Sylvia Law, a law professor who worked with RBG in the 70s, because she is a complete, unique, and wonderful gem on the court. There are so many cases, especially technical cases, where you read the majority and it doesn't seem all that bad, and then you read Ruth's dissent and you realize they have just done something terrible. Justices try not to acknowledge what everyone else knows, which is that they tend to share many of the values of the president who appointed them. Each time she was asked about retirement, RBG walked a careful line. There will be a president after this one, and I'm hopeful that that president will be a fine president, she said. In another interview, with Nina Totenberg, she went even further, offering, Well, I'm very hopeful about 2016. One reporter said she nodded when it was said aloud that the next presidential election could bring the first female president. Yes, RBG replied, and wouldn't that be fantastic? A Hillary Clinton presidency might be the perfect moment for her to step down, but for now, she stays because she loves the job. RBG has her own metric for when it's time to go. When I forget the names of cases that I once could recite at the drop of a hat, she said, I will know. She's not there yet. Seeking out the joys of being alive. Do you want to see Marty's kitchen? RBG recently asked her friend Anita Fial when she visited RBG's Watergate apartment. It is still Marty's kitchen. Except these days, Jane comes down from New York and spends weekends at her mother's house cooking.
In the freezer, Jane leaves behind little packages of meals, each marked chicken or fish.
"Sometimes she'll be going to sleep just as I'm waking up," says Jane. "If I see that the paper has been brought inside, I know it's not because she got up early."
Her mother still spends the weekends catching up on sleep she misses during the week. Life after Marty has fallen into a kind of rhythm. In the old days, as she worked until the job was done, Marty would tell her that if she went to bed, in the morning everything would be clearer.
"He was right," RBG said after Marty's death. "Sometimes I feel like I'm in a maze, then go to sleep thinking about the way out, and when I wake up in the morning, I see the path. But now there's no one telling me it's time to quit."
On mornings that the court is in session, the U.S. Marshals make sure she's awake. "She lives off coffee," says her granddaughter Clara, who lived with her grandmother for a summer. "Without it, she will not engage." Asked what had been the most surprising thing about growing older, RBG was characteristically crisp.
"Nothing surprised me, but I've learned two things. One is to seek ever more the joys of being alive, because who knows how much longer I will be living. At my age, one must take things day by day." She added, "I had some trying times when my husband died. We'd been married for 56 years and knew each other for 60. Now, 4 years later, I'm doing what I think he would have wanted me to do."
Her grandson, Paul, wishes Marty had been there to get a kick out of one recent scene. A couple of years ago, Paul, an actor, went to visit her in Washington. She'd given him his pick of plays that were supposed to be good. They were in the car, on their way back from somewhere, and as usual there were two marshals, one driving, one in the passenger seat, looking stoic. Paul says, "She asked the marshal if she could call the theater to book us tickets and warn them we'd be coming because they always have to do their marshal's security check." The lady marshal asked, "What's the name of the show?" RBG had chosen Cock, a play by Mike Bartlett. "It's called Cock," she told the marshal. "She could have been saying The Duke's Red Horse," says Paul. The marshal dutifully picked up the phone to secure tickets on behalf of Justice Ginsburg to Cock. Throughout it all, RBG sat, unperturbed, in the back seat. She had been going to the theater for a long time. Free to Be, You and Me. On April 28, 2015, 37-year-old Dan Cannon had followed the rules. It was his first time taking a case to the Supreme Court, intimidating even if it weren't one of the most important civil rights cases of our time, Obergefell v. Hodges. The shaved-headed former musician turned civil rights lawyer was there to represent people whose marriages didn't count in Kentucky, because they were two men or two women. From the counsel's table, where Dan was sitting, he could have reached up and grabbed Justice Samuel Alito. He didn't. Outside the court, there were pre-printed posters about abomination, but also rainbow flags and a Grandparents for Justice sign. There was one Marry Me Scalia placard. For months, there had been calls for RBG to recuse herself, because she had performed two same-sex weddings shortly after the Supreme Court struck down the Defense of Marriage Act. She ignored them. Inside, as oral argument was in full swing, she offered a rebuttal to the argument that same-sex couples could not be led into marriage because the institution was rooted in millennia of tradition. "There was a change in the institution of marriage to make it egalitarian when it wasn't egalitarian," RBG cut in. "And same-sex unions wouldn't fit into what marriage was once." She herself had helped remake marriage, freeing it from the laws circumscribing roles for men and women. A tradition that saw women as property would not have recognized RBG's own marriage. Solicitor General Donald Verrilli, who was arguing on behalf of the government that day, wore the traditional morning coat with tails. There is a dress code at the Supreme Court for people like Cannon, too. Appropriate attire for counsel is conservative business dress in traditional dark colors, for example navy blue or charcoal gray, reads the official guide for lawyers bringing cases to the Supreme Court. Cannon complied, wearing a navy suit jacket and a sky blue button-down shirt. Before he had come to Washington, Cannon had received a present from a law school friend and her wife, a school teacher. They had married in New York, but only one mother's name appeared on their son's birth certificate, because Kentucky voters decided Lori and Crystal's marriage shouldn't count. Under his button-down, Cannon had a secret. He wore his friend's gift, a notorious RBG T-shirt. Kennedy would be the one to write the opinion striking down bans on same-sex marriage,